This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Place to Be Nation, welcome to the epicenter of Southern wrestling. JT Allen, this is Letters from Center Stage Theater.
As the biggest night in the history of this great organization.
You are gonna feel the bad!
Place to Be Nation, welcome to episode number 7 of Letters from Center Stage. I am JT, and we are here, of course, in our offices in Atlanta, Georgia, to dive deep into the outer rim of nostalgia mothership that is WCW. And joining me, as always, on that voyage is my partner here on the show, the chap they call Alan. Alan, how are you, sir?
I am wonderful, as always. I'm making my own make of the Bad Blaster. I'm calling it the Blackstock Blaster. And when I run into Parv next, I'm going to blast it in his face.
I like it. Blast it all over him. Episode 7 already. We are churning through these things, Alan.
Yeah, no, we're going great guns, aren't we? Episode 7 into what we should be on an ongoing series of shows. I don't think we've got an end date in sight. Still so much to talk about. Every single episode, we tend to be saying, oh, we'll come back to that, or I'd love to talk that a bit more in depth. So I'm going to need to actually make a list of the things that I've said we can actually revisit again. But I think the first question on this is a revisit from the past. So shall we go ahead and get ourselves into that plunder bucket, JT?
I think so. And I will say this, that's who you brought him up. Alan, listen to me right now. We're going to be here until we get canceled, just like WCW was. So if, you know, Brad and the powers that be over at PTBN decide to just pull the plug one day, well, that might be it. But until then, we're going to go strong. And we're going to continue going strong by diving deep inside the plunder bucket of mailbag questions here tonight. And what is question number one?
Hi, I'm Missy Hyatt, and welcome to Missy Does the Mail. This week's letter comes from Nikki Davis of Long Beach, California, who wants to know what I think of the new U.S. heavyweight champion.
Okay, the first question, it's going back to a question that Adam from New Jersey asked on episode 5 about WCW Power Plant. So the second bit of the question is, dear Alan and JT, can you tell me a bit about the info about developmental shows around Atlanta that WCW ran for Power Plant trainees? So this is quite an interesting one, because I did touch on it briefly on episode 5, JT, and I just wanted to do a bit more in depth to give Adam the answer he's probably looking for. So we went through the results, looked at some things that they did, and it was the developmental shows as such was just they ran a weekly show for around about 7 or 8 weeks at the back end of 93 from the Crystal Chandelier nightclub in Kennesaw, Georgia.
Are we sure that's a nightclub?
Well, I'm not sure. Strip joint are you going for there, JT?
I am. I just assumed Johnny Sauro was doing the ring announcing.
The shows themselves, they didn't draw very well at all, did they, JT? Looking at the first one, September the 21st, 93, 42 people paid to see a show that featured, and this is a show, you know, that should, you know, sell out arenas around the country. We've got Jim Steele defeated Letters from Center Stage favorite, The Gambler, in the opener.
Poor guy, can't even win this match in the nightclub, The Gambler.
No, I know, it's a sad day. We had Sergeant Buddy Lee Parker defeated Bobby Walker. We have Lightning out of the tag team. Who was he tagging with? What was the other way?
Thunder. Thunder and Lightning. And they ripped that off from our Backyard Wrestling Federation. Thunder and Lightning were the WCF tag team champions, and they stole it from us, Alan. They stole it.
Gimmick infringement. Oh, my word. So Lightning, he defeated Big Bad John via DQ. And in the main event of this, you know, stacked show, we had Shanghai Pierce and Tex Slazenger defeating Johnny B. Bad and Keith Cole. So, wow.
I'm hoping Cole took the pin, but the Cole twins yet again, of course. They get mentioned at least once an episode here on Letters from Center Stage. Interesting main event. I mean, you know, Shanghai and Tex can say they won a main event match on a show, I guess, in WCW. But 42 is a little soft, yeah, especially in a nightclub setting. I mean, you'd think they could fit more people than that in the building. But I'll tell you, Alan, these things may have picked up some steam, because as you're going to cover, The numbers started to tick up a little bit. So may the word started to get passed around Kennesaw, and people started coming out for these things.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the next week, this was September the 28th, it drew a massive 58 people. So there was an extra 16 people buying tickets for this show. So word must have spread.
That's a good percentage bump, though, when you go from 42 to 58. Like, that's not awful, right? I mean, that's – I'm not good at math. But it's I think it's a decent percentage raise.
So just on this show, we had the Ace. I have no idea who the Ace is. And he defeated our friend the Gambler.
You think it was Bob Orton?
Yeah, well, that would have been a cool match, actually. But no, I don't think it was Bob Orton. But poor Gambler, that's 2 weeks in a row now. He's been curtain jerking and staring up at the ceiling, you know, for this show. Next one, we had Buddy Lee Parker defeated Brian Anderson. He was a guy that was, you know, he was getting trained in by someone like Buddy Lee Parker. I'd imagine that was a reason to put them in together, because Buddy Lee Parker was always around, and we touched on that with the power plant, you know, bringing up guys, kind of getting them ready for a bigger, you know, bigger stage.
And we saw that one with Bobby Walker that we'll talk about a little bit, I think. So, you know, that could have been an ongoing feud as Bobby Walker came out of the training facility. And that was almost a 30% bump in attendance, Alan. So no joke from 42 to 58 right there.
Look at that. Good math there on the fly there, JT. I'm impressed. We also had on the show, this is great, Terry Taylor defeating Mike Winners. We have Terry Taylor in 93. That guy never got a break, did he, after the Red Rooster? I mean, he's working 58 in front of 58 paid. That's crazy for a guy. He was a big star in the mid-80s in Mid-South UWF. I mean,
he always seems so sad, too, when he comes out. He's just like, he's just got nothing. I mean, yeah, I think the Red Rooster gimmick is to blame mostly. But and maybe this is something we can cover on another episode if someone writes in about it. But how much is on him as well? We've seen guys get real shit gimmicks and make it work or rebound and succeed later on. It didn't hang over him that badly. I mean, he couldn't have found a way to get himself over further. He'd have runs in both WWF and WCW, multiple in WCW again. I think it partially falls on him and his inability to get himself over. I mean, they were giving him the chance by just, all right, here's terrific Terry Taylor, you know, like go out there and work and talk and get yourself over. And he just never seemed to connect even that. So to me, it's like soft to always blame the Rooster for this guy's deficiencies.
Well, I think that's fair. But I did like the tailor-made money. He had a better look when he dyed his hair, you know, it kind of black and slicked it all back.
True.
I think that was an all right look. But yeah, apart from that, Terry Taylor, just as plain Terry Taylor, just didn't work in this era. So the next one, we had Pez Watley fought Michael Hayes to a double count out. Wow. And in the main event, we had this awesome team of Bobby Eaton and Yoshi Kwan, which was, I think, was that Chris Champion?
Yes, it was. And he was brought in by Harley Race as like kind of to feed to Cactus Jack before Vader.
Yeah, and they defeated Thunder and Lightning. So that was the second show. And then we're still building here, JT. This is another massive bump. The third show, which was October 5, 93, 113 paid, JT. So
that's
wow, we've got it. Hats off. Hats off to WCW here for building an audience and, you know, over doubling it from the first week.
Yeah, good for them. Yeah, definitely. They you know, they're gaining some steam. The word's starting to spread. You want to come see one of the Cole twins. You want to see Yoshi Kwan or Buddy Lee Parker. Like, this is the place to be right here, you know, no pun intended.
And on this show, we had Tom Zenk defeated Terry Taylor, so poor Terry Taylor again.
Jobbing in the opener at the Crystal Chandelier.
Yeah, we had Big Bad John went to a double DQ with Jim Steele. We had Ice Train defeated Michael Hayes via DQ, so that was two kind of screw finishes in a row. And then we had Max Payne defeated Brad Armstrong. And this is something that I may ask him about. We had Lord Steven Regal defeated Johnny B. Badd. So I just noticed him in the results here. I didn't notice it when I did the research. So I'm going to ask him if he has any memories of working the fantastic Crystal Chandelier Nightclub. And I'll report back on that one, hopefully, in the coming weeks.
Very good.
And then we had Tex Lazinger and Shanghai Pierce defeated Thunder and Lightning. So that was them on a roll now. They won in the first week and the third week. But looking at the actual results and just going through them, Tom Zenk and Terry Taylor, two guys on a developmental show. They were there, obviously, to sort of quote-unquote draw, maybe, because they'd been on TV.
Right.
But wouldn't it have been more beneficial to put them against, say, we had a Big Bad John fought Jim Steele to a DQ in the second match? Would it have not been great to kind of flip-flop them and have one of them working against the, you know, more seasoned veterans?
Yeah, I think so, unless they wanted to, you know, they kind of did that the first couple weeks, so maybe they were like, all right, we'll set the stage, and then let's see if these guys can go out and piece together a match. It's just kind of a training ground. So it could have been that mentality as well.
Yeah,
I look back at the dates, Alan. These were Tuesday nights.
Right. So they were Tuesday. So we're not. Yeah. It was kind of a hard sell to draw on a Tuesday night in Kennesaw, Georgia. But yeah, we didn't get the draw. How many people got paid for the? For the next two shows. But on December the 14th, which was I think the sixth show, 121 paid, and that was the last show that we saw them run here. But just going through the results then of all of them, looking at them here, that the people that WCW would have classed as their developmental around this time then would have been Jim Steele, Bobby Walker, Thunder and Lightning, Big Bad John, Keith and Ken. The Cole Twins, anyway.
Yeah, Ken,
I think looking through, they're the main guys, aren't they? This is four, really. Maybe Texas Ninja and Shanghai Pierce as well, because they're all over these shows. And I don't think they'd. Had they worked TV at this point? I think they had actually in 93. So I don't know, really, if that was to help them as well. But yeah, it was mainly for the guys I mentioned and Brian Anderson as well.
Right. I mean, they're sending lower level TV guys there to mix up the card, to draw the name, and then they're letting the young guys work underneath and learn either against the veterans or against each other. I mean, in late 93, if you look at the names here, besides Regal, all of these guys, I mean, I guess maybe Bad, right? I mean, but the rest of these guys are all pretty much just the lowest level until you get this December 14th, you get an Austin Pillman. So, I mean, they were sending some guys down there to help draw, but mostly it's the lower end of the card, other than maybe a handful of guys that pop in and out. Cactus Jack.
I'll just stop you there, JT. We've got former NWA World Heavyweight Champion Tommy Rich defeated Tom Zenk on that December the 14th show.
I'll tell you, that was one of the biggest ones. They had Pillman versus Austin, Scorpio and Bagwell against Pretty Wonderful, Rich and Zenk, and then Cactus and Max Payne against Tex and Shanghai. That's a pretty good crowd. That's not a bad card for this. 121 paid to come see that show. That's not awful.
I would have loved this show because also we had the Gambler. He didn't lose. He went to a draw with Craig Pittman in the opener, so he's improving slowly, which was great to see.
Yeah, that's basically a win for him, so that's great.
Awesome. So, yeah, they were the kind of shows that they ran, which was to help the guys get a bit of work in front of a crowd, even though there were small crowds. The crowd, nevertheless, and it's still experience at the end of the day. So I'm not going to really mock WCW for this.
I like the idea. I think it's a good idea. Yeah. I mean, why not? Like, this is the stuff that they should have been doing, and this is stuff that WWF was not doing at the time. You know, they didn't start building up the developmental program until Jim Ross really gained a lot of power in the late 90s, because he was one of the vocal, you know, leaders that was always saying we have to build some kind of farm system to replenish ourselves. And it wasn't until like that 97-ish period where they started doing the Funkin' Dojos and all that stuff that they really started to build some kind of, you know, feeder system for themselves. And WCW was ahead of them at that point, not only with the power plant, but also with stuff like this. Where they were running these kind of shows and getting guys trained and doing things, you know, having their own school basically to prop themselves up instead of always having to worry about, you know, feeding from the indies or feeding from WWF.
Yeah, no, it was a good idea. And I think I'm not going to mock, as I said, they paid what they got for these shows because the purpose was just simply to get the guys in front of a crowd. But what I am going to mock is some other bad crowds from 1993, which was with the main talent. I mean, I don't have the actual cards in front of me, but just this is how many people WCW were drawing in 93. This is how bad it got in the kind of summer months. We had June 6th, they drew 225 in Kings Mountain, North Carolina, 310 on July the 28th at Burlington in a baseball stadium in North Carolina, Attila, Alabama, at the Wayman Townsville Gym Fieldhouse, 250, 130 in Bloomfield, Illinois, 150 in Martinsville, Illinois, 150 in Linton, Indiana, I stand corrected, Kingsport, Tennessee, 475, and in Atlanta, Georgia, at the Omni on October the 3rd, 800 paid, and the front row seats sold by scalpers for actually $1. That's how the interest just wasn't there. And then finally, Johnson City, Tennessee, October 22, 93, 100 people.
No show in Peoria, though. That's sad. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm curious what these cards were and, you know, what the goal was. Like an armory. Will they fit more than $150? I don't know how many people. I guess it depends on the size of the building. But, you know, 310 in a baseball stadium, if they're sitting on the floor, I guess, isn't awful. But they, I mean, it was a soft time overall. I mean, even the WWF, you know, numbers were down overall, drawing time. It was a big part of what WCW was going through when they were trying to then reposition themselves to sign Hulk Hogan in 1994, because they were struggling to find an identity to draw steadily, and business-wise, this was not a great year. I guess one of my questions is, when did Bischoff take over? Because I'm curious if it was him that actually put these Crystal Chandelier show was into place. I mean, I guess he would have been running things by then, right? Because Watts was gone in early 93.
Yeah, we had Watts. We had Kip Fry, remember, as well.
Yeah, he was so before.
He was before. The timeline for me, because it was spoken about, I was listening to Between the Sheets and the went through Bischoff's kind of tenure, because he gave the interview with the Torch, I think, in kind of April, March 94. And I think that was realistically when he gained his full power. So I don't think he had full control at this point from memory.
Okay, but he was like executive producer or whatever it was in... I think it was after Watts he took over, because Schiavone wanted the job and then they gave it to Bischoff and whatever. So I think he was in charge partially at this point anyway. So I'm just curious if this was him putting these things into, you know, action, or if it was someone else.
But just to give context, though, just to the show. So WCW, the show I mentioned on August 13, which drew 130 people. There were only two shows that night. So this was the B show.
Okay.
So we had Eric Watts defeated Chris Benoit. We had Yoshi Kwan defeating Frankie Lancaster. Mark Starr defeated Big Sky. Scorpio and Bagwell defeated Harlem Heat. And Johnny B. Badd defeated Max Payne. So it was not a loaded show at all, but still
not far off from the Chandelier shows. I mean, really,
but you know, they had stars on the show still, and you know, we had Max Payne, Johnny B. Badd were on a TV feud around this time that we discussed on the last episode.
Mm-hmm.
Harlem Heat had been on TV, you know, for some time at that point. Bagwell had been on TV for a couple of years. You know, I would have expected a little bit more, but you know, at the end of the day, they drew what they drew. But 93 wasn't a good, you know, year for anyone on the road, WCW or WWF. But this was kind of example of when WCW really hit the bottom.
Agreed. I mean, yeah, they were bottoming out. And then in early 94, you know, in early 94, they're trying to piece things back together. Quality-wise, the show gets pretty good. And even, I would even argue 93. I mean, it's not awful. There's some shaky stuff in there. But it wasn't until Hogan came that the business started to turn around. And even that took a couple of years to really get going, so...
Yeah, so hopefully that's answered the question there about the developmental shows, and kind of we added the supplementary kind of poorly drew shows that they drew around that time as well. But that was quite interesting. So shall we go ahead and answer the second question?
Let's do it.
Okay, so Dear Alan and JT, my favorite wrestler from WCW is Sergeant Buddy Lee Parker. Can you please review Buddy's career highlights and Buddy's greatest feuds on Letters from Center Stage? And that's from Anthony Hitchcock in Newark, New Jersey. So... wow, thanks for the question. Buddy Lee Parker is your favourite wrestler. This is Buddy Lee Parker, who's been part of State Patrol, part of Men at Work, and he's done some other fun stuff as well in his WCW tenure. And he's been around quite a while, hasn't he, JT?
Hitchcock. Was he part of Men at Work? I didn't realise he was in that team. That was Canyon and Mark Starr, wasn't it?
Mark Starr. I think he was in it before that.
Oh, interesting.
So we actually had, though, Buddy Lee Parker, Dwayne, as we refer to him on this show.
Dwayne.
He'd been around since 89, hadn't he? So he'd been in WCW he'd been one of the longest serving guys in some ways. It'd be Sting and him and, you know, a couple of others I'm forgetting off the top of my head.
He's got to be 89. One of the few that was there pretty much from, like, when the promotion became WCW. Like, I mean, pretty much right after it, right? Because that was late 88. And then he's there till it closes. So, yeah, I mean, he's got to be pretty much... if not the, or like you said, one of, along with Sting, the longest tenured guys that never left.
Well, yeah, he was there as you said, when it closed, but it was in doing pay-per-view matches in 2001. So this tells you where WCW was at that point. And
right.
the match in question, I think it was WCW Sin. Did he work a pay-per-view? I may be wrong now.
Yeah, he did. Himself. He teamed with his protege, Goldberg. Against Totally Buff, right? Was that their name? Luger and Buff Bagwell?
Oh, no, of course, yeah. That was his last actual match as well in WCW. Yeah. Was that pay-per-view with him and Goldberg.
And it cost Goldberg his career, right? Wasn't that like a retirement match or whatever?
Yeah, it was. Explain to people who weren't aware the whole Goldberg and Dwayne Bruce kind of storyline.
Well, Goldberg had trained in the power plant. So they started to kind of bring up, you know, his relationship with Bruce in early 01. And then they had a match where they were forced to fight each other. It's on the playlist. And that was toward the end of 2000, where Luger basically comes out and, you know, they have to fight and they kind of expose the relationship. And Goldberg is a little hesitant, but then Bruce goes right at him and then Goldberg beats him. And then Bruce kind of just gets inserted into this feud between Goldberg and Totally Buff. He has matches on Thunder with Bagwell and Luger. And then that builds to they have a tag match at a house show. And then that builds to, the one at Sin, and I believe the one at Sin had Goldberg's career on the line. Because the idea was that all these guys were going to get run out of the company. Steiner was going to hurt a bunch of guys. And then they'd come back, and eventually I think Goldberg was going to be the one to beat Steiner after everyone else, you know, after Steiner runs through everybody else. So Goldberg, I don't know. I have to dig a little deeper. Yeah, right here. So if Goldberg lost, he'd have to retire. The match started with Goldberg against Bagwell. Goes from there, and then Luger lifted Goldberg on his shoulders, and Bagwell hit a super blockbuster after Bruce ended up kind of getting beat up, and Goldberg got distracted. So Luger covered, and that ended Goldberg's undefeated streak of 35 this time around.
Wow.
And forced him to retire from pro wrestling.
But that wasn't my favorite Buddy Lee Parker kind of moment. That was his most high profile in some ways. Right. I mean, he was on some other pay-per-views. He worked World War III, but every kind of person that was associated with WCW would have worked those shows. 60-man three-ring battle royals. You need any hands on deck for that one. He also, in Battle Bowl in 91 Starcade, where he infamously got beaten up by Abdullah the Butcher, which is, as I've mentioned a few times, one of my favourite WCW moments. I still take great delight in seeing that. But yeah, I think what we both found, or what I knew about this before anyway, but I went back and just watched it for the absurdity of it, was the short-lived gimmick of Buddy as the Leprechaun, as part of the Dungeon of Doom. So, wow. He has this match, doesn't he, JT, on... what was it? It was a WCW Pro against Todd Martin. So, Todd Martin, if anyone doesn't know, is the... Todd Martin, sorry. My goodness, awful. I'm talking there.
Todd Morton.
Tom Martin of Wrestling Observer in Torch fame, not him. Todd Morton, cousin of Ricky Morton.
Cousin? It looked like it was Ricky Morton pretending his name was Todd. I mean, that's how much... I mean, that was basically him, it seemed like. He had the same mullet.
Oh, everything the same. Look, he was a couple of inches... just a little bit shorter. And Ricky Morton wasn't really that tall. But yeah, Todd Morton was just basically midget, you know, Ricky Morton... in some ways. But Todd Morton had worked WCW, did some kind of jobbing. He'd also worked in the WWF in 94. He worked a challenge taping. I think it was an attack team that lost to the Heavenly Bodies. And he was working some dark matches in the WWF in 2000 as well, on the road to get some guys ready. But so that's kind of my mention there of Todd Morton. But yeah, the Leprechaun stuff. I witnessed the greatest thing I've seen for Buddy Lee Parker, maybe. He did a springboard to the outside. Double axe handle.
He did it. He actually did. So on the playlist, there's like 13 Buddy Lee Parker matches. So if you've never seen one, this is the show for you right now. But, you know, he did it as Buddy Lee Parker in a match with Bobby Walker on Saturday night. He went to the air and did a springboard dive off the top rope to the floor. He like leapt up onto the middle of the rope, the top rope, and then dove off. And then he did it off the top rope as well into the ring. And that match with Bobby Walker, he actually looked pretty good. That was Bobby Walker's debut. And that's what I was mentioning. I think maybe he was out there working with him to kind of get him up and running. But it wasn't a bad match. You know, Parker wasn't terrible overall. Like, technically, he's fine. I think he was just lacking the charisma or look to ever really be elevated past what he was. He was just a really good hand to help train these guys and get them ready and then go work with them. But yet the Leprechaun, so he's got the match with Todd Morton, like you mentioned, on the weekend show. And then he's actually... kind of part of a Nitro match where they have a 4-on-4 at the Dungeon of Doom against the Pretty Boys. If you remember, they had done a vignette of these guys running on the beach. It was I think it was Renegade, Joe Gomez, Alex Wright, and there's one more. Was it
just geeks? Just utter geeks.
Maybe American Males were in there too, or I don't know. There was like four or five of them that they showed like running on the beach and getting ready, and they're, you know, all jacked up, and they fight the Dungeon of Doom in this four way, and the Leprechaun in this 4-on-4, and the Leprechaun comes out for this one. He's one of the fourth guys. All he does is spend the whole time running around the ring. This was at the MGM location for Nitro, the outdoor one. He's just like sprinting around the ring and crazed. And I'll tell you, he did a pretty good job masking himself. I mean, in that match, if you really look, like when he takes his shirt off and he's got the singlet and you kind of look at his face, you can see who it is. But he acted completely differently. Like, he was really manic running around and everything. So I thought he did a nice job kind of masking who it was.
Yeah, no, definitely. I agree, because he actually put contact lenses in as well, because I've seen a picture of him, and he kind of did his hair differently, dyed it a brown color rather than what it was before. So he went away from Buddy Lee Parker that look. But yeah, the giveaway was the singlet underneath, which I thought hurt the character. You have a Leprechaun, a mad guy, and he happens to have a wrestling singlet underneath his shirt that kind of gets ripped off during the match.
Yeah, it was a little weird.
It was a little weird, but yeah, the matches, I'm going to have to track down this. 1997, would you have loved to have seen Greg Valentine versus Buddy Lee Parker on WCW Saturday Night?
Yeah, why not? Valentine was really good, and Parker was a good wrestler, technically. So I think it would have been pretty good. The Leprechaun thing, too, as stupid as it sounds, actually, I thought it kind of fit the dungeon gimmick. Like, it kind of made sense that they had a sadistic, crazed Leprechaun sprinting around the ring like a madman within the concept of their gimmick. Like, I don't think he works in many other realms of wrestling, but this one, I don't know, I thought he kind of fit the idea of it.
He's biting him in the armpit. Well, he can find flesh.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, you red-headed booger, you.
How about Jimmy Hart cannot control Braun the Leprechaun?
Look at him.
Yeah, no, I mean, the run itself as the Leprechaun literally lasted, you know, a couple of tapings, I think. We had the Nitro appearance, which I think was that at Disney MGM anyway, that Nitro.
Yeah, that was the outside.
It was outside, wasn't it? Yeah. So I think it was that. It worked worldwide. I think it was all on the same kind of weekend then, because he was beating Joe Gomez, Chad Brock on Worldwide, and also, as we mentioned, on WCW Pro, beating Tom Morton. So I really like this little gimmick, this little run as the Leprechaun. And definitely, if people want to seek it out, I recommend you do so on the playlists. So have you got any other... Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I was going to say, the Leprechaun too. Wasn't the rumor always, a lot of people thought that was Crash Holly, because if you remember, he had done a Leprechaun gimmick on the indie scene before he came in as Crash, and many always just kind of assumed that was him because it was so brief, and back then, I don't know, a lot of the people just probably didn't get a solid look, so that was always like one of the big rumors that was out in the Wild West days of the internet back in 98 99, was that it was him that was the, you know, Aaron O'Grady or whatever was the Leprechaun here, and of course, yeah, then it was later revealed that it was Buddy Lee Parker. But
no, that's it. Have you got any other kind of Buddy Lee Parker memories you want to talk about?
Yeah, so I watched some of his matches, and one of the ones he actually got over pretty well, he fought David Flair, and this was like when they were doing the big Ric Flair collusion stuff where he's like the president, you got Charles Robinson as the crooked ref, and the Horseman as the backup, and Arn is out there, you know, barking orders, and Parker, he was ordered to lay down for David. And he goes rogue in the match, and he's, like, beating the shit out of David, and then he ends up losing after some interference, and David gets him in the figure four. But it actually was one of the better things I saw from Parker. Like, it was kind of cool. Like, he got all fired up, and basically was like, fuck you, fuck the establishment. I'm just going to beat the shit out of this kid and try and get a win finally. So I thought that was pretty neat. I also was very confused when he switched to the army gear instead of the cop look. And he still was Buddy Lee Parker, like the one I watched where he fights Finley in 98. He just suddenly is an army guy. Like, do you know, was there an explanation behind that change, or did he just get tired of being a cop?
Yeah, I think he was just tired of being, you know, part of state.
I didn't know you could graduate from just being a cop to, like, an army cadet or a veteran,
well,
I guess.
It wasn't really a cop. It was more of a traffic cop, wouldn't you say, as well, with his pal.
Security guard, maybe.
Yeah, it was. I think it was a step up as part of the army gimmick. But yeah, I don't think it was ever explained. If any listeners of the show kind of come across anything that does explain it, please let us know. But I don't think, from memory, anything was really explained on TV about the, you know, the changing cosmetic look. But yeah, it was a great hand. I mean, 89 to 2001, navigating the murky political waters of WCW all that time, getting a nice kind of office job, so to speak, in some ways, doing the power plant stuff, you know, barking orders, beasting guys, you know, and Louis Theroux on that documentary that we talked about on episode 5. Yeah, I think Buddy Lee Parker, he's got short man syndrome, definitely. I really get that vibe from him.
Oh, for sure. But I'll say this, watching the matches actually gave me a slight, I don't say appreciation, but he's better than I remembered. Like, he's not just your standard jobber, you know, like a gambler or like that level of guy. Like, he was, you know, I think he was a little bit notch up. He was pretty skilled when it came to the basics of wrestling. So he wasn't out there, like, embarrassing himself at all. He was out there having pretty good matches. I could see why he'd be, like, a barometer. He reminded me of, like a Rene Goulet, just without the past. You know what I mean? Like, a guy that you can use as a measuring stick, then go out there and just be fine. You can stick a kid with him. You can stick a vet with him. He's not going to embarrass you. He can go 10 minutes. He can go 3 minutes. That's what he reminded me of. I got just a guy like that. That's just around. He's not going to hurt you. He's not going to do much, but he's not going to actively, like, stink out the joint. Unless he's fighting 1990 Junkyard Dog, who's got El Gigante on the apron in his corner for some reason. But if you want to crash course in Buddy Lee Parker and see that he really wasn't that bad, I guess, check out the playlist, because there's like 12 or 13 matches on there, and he looks pretty good in all of them. I mean, I'm not going to say he should have been pushed beyond what he was, but he's not, like, an embarrassment at all.
Taylor, I think, has a little ropier muscle than Parker. Parker appears to be a little short and chunky in that respect in the muscle area. But Parker now has got his problems coming up.
No, so there we go. I hope he goes up in people's estimations there. Dwayne Bruce. So he's still knocking around, I think. I don't know. I think he opened his own training school in 2003 from memory. So he's not online anywhere. I don't see him post anywhere. But yeah, Buddy Lee Parker. Good hand. So,
and of course, you mentioned the question there. And you mentioned the Vincent moment, of course, last week. But that's one that's worth checking out as well, where Vincent just decides to give him a brain buster on the edge of the apron for no reason.
Oh, of course, that slipped my mind. But yeah, that's one of my favorite Buddy Lee Parker memories as well. So
unfortunately, it's not one of his memories because I don't think he probably remembers it.
Yeah, don't think he remembered that. A bit concussed after that. So shall I now do what I do every week and jump inside my automobile?
I think you should, Alan. And I picture it being like a convertible or something, because it is time for the 1-800-COLLECT Road Report, looking back at this week in WCW history with my partner Alan.
Cold?
Tony, I am cold, but the only thing keeping me warm here is the cheeseheads. I mean, the fans here haven't been this excited since the Bucks won the coin toss and got Al Cinder as their first pick.
Right, we're going to go now to June the 5th, 2000, episode of Nitro from Atlanta, Georgia. And this was the show where Eric Bischoff defeated Terry Funk to win the WCW Hardcore title. Eric Bischoff winning the title in 2000, I wasn't surprised really, because Vince had done this in 99. Russo had done this as well, I think, in 99 in WCW. Am I right in getting my timeline right there, JT?
Russo was actually after this. He was.
Was it?
He was the fall of 2000 when he won the WCW title in the, I think he did it in the War Games. That was on Nitro or whatever. And then he ended up getting the concussion. But yeah, because he doesn't go to WCW till the late 99, and then he's only there for like a month and a half, and he's not even on screen. That's when he's doing the powers that be thing, where he's like just his voice or whatever in the back of his head, like George Steinbrenner on Seinfeld. But yeah, once him and Bischoff come back in April is when they're both on screen.
So yeah, Bischoff picking up a title. I mean, it wasn't a high profile title, probably the lowest title, single title in WCW at the time, which was straight knockoff of WWF and their success with having their hardcore title started a couple of years earlier with Mankind at Survivor Series 98, and then going on and being defended 24/7. So WCW obviously trying to copy something WWF did that was a success and had it. Terry Funk was the right fit for a guy to have the title. There was other guys who feuded over this title at the time. We had guys like Finlay. We had Jerry Sags. It was Brian Knobbs, wasn't it? He was one of the other guys dressed in camo gear, if you remember, around this time, JT.
Yeah, it was a weird division. Bigelow, Knobs, Finley.
Hack.
Who? Yeah, Hack. Norman Smiley. Was Jerry Flynn in there, too? I remember he used to wrestle on the block. It was like that fucking random room of cement or whatever. It was a weird division. They had the Junkyard Invitational. And it was, I would say that's probably the most worthless. Between WWF and WCW's titles in like the 90s, like that, you know, when they were the most popular, do you think the WCW hardcore title is the most worthless? Maybe the WWF lightweight was up there too. Those two were probably the most worthless titles.
Or the TV title that Hacksaw Jim Duggan found in the bin.
Yeah, but that had some legacy behind it. Like, to me, these two, like the hardcore title and the light heavyweight, never had like anything. Like, they were just trash from beginning to end.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair too. It was just the fact that WCW, you know, a title that had been resurrected from a bin was just ludicrous. But that's hopefully something we can talk about in a future episode if someone asks.
And then didn't Lance Storm win it, and it was a Saskatchewan Hardcore Invitational title or something? Maybe it was the shit. That's what he called it.
Yeah, that's when he held all those singles titles at once. I think. Bischoff only had the title, though, for a day. So the next night on the Thunder taping, he lost it to Big Vito and Johnny the Bull Stamboli. So he didn't actually lose it. So that was Bischoff's only singles title in the world of wrestling, and that beating a former NWA World Champion Terry Funk.
Of course, why not? I mean, I think this was probably during the I don't have the Millionaires Club started yet. Like, I think so, right? This was right during the New Blood versus Millionaire, at least
the
veterans.
In April.
Yeah. So this is all part of that. Terry Funk's part of the veteran group, and you know, Eric Bischoff and Russo were championing the young guys. So that was the. I still don't know who's the face or heel in that whole thing, but whatever. Bischoff defeats Terry Funk.
That'll be the whole kind of reason why the titles forfeited to Stamboli and Vito on the Thunder taping for that reason, because those guys were part of the young blood or the up-and-comers, weren't they?
Yeah, new blood.
New blood. So, yeah, that's on this week in history, June the 5th, 2000. So, Eric Bischoff, I don't think he'd probably even remember if you'd ask him, did he win a title. I don't think it's a career memory for him. I think his biggest achievements were, you know, still to this day, he'll probably say beating, you know, WWF in the ratings for, you know, 80-odd weeks.
Right.
So, yeah, not a big major thing for him to remember either. So shall we move on to the long topic?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's see what's cooking for us.
Okay, and this is, on a previous episode of the podcast, you spoke about some of the best WCW matches. I'll have you both to come up with your top 10. Really enjoy the show. Some TV matches that people might not be aware of would be great as well. And that's from Jonathan LaRue in Northport, Alabama. So thank you very much for the question, Jonathan. So, I mean, we've got the standard ones that, you know, are always right. mentioned. Like we touched on last week's show, the other week's show, we're talking Wrestle War 92. But let's get these out of the way first. What are your top kind of WCW matches?
Oh man, yeah. I mean, obviously the War Games that we talked about. Eddie Ray, I think, has to be in the conversation always. Halloween Havoc '97. I mean, how do you leave out the Flair Steamboat Triumvirate from '89? I mean, I think those are inside our purview, right? We pretty much are talking end of '88. Nasties versus Cactus and Pain. Love that match, and I love the. I say it's the greatest in WCW history. No, but they're my favorite to watch, and my favorite to watch are the Boss versus Vader in '94. Just brutal, brutal matches where they just beat the shit out of each other. You know, a lot of Super Bowl '92, Liger Pillman. Yeah, there's just a lot of good stuff. I mean, there's a lot, so many high quality matches, and a great resource is like when Chad and Parv on Where the Big Boys Played did their like TV year in review. Pieces and both on that and even you know others. I'm trying to think if it was Exile or Between the Two, but they've talked about like a lot of like the Dangerous Alliance TV matches. So I mean, there's so many good matches that are out there that are worth seeking out. And I mean, Flair and Funk, the I Quit. I mean, there's just so many good matches out there that maybe I don't say have been lost to time, but unless you're really like an aficionado of WCW, you may have overlooked outside of the top five or so.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, other matches, just to mention, with stuff like Rage Jr., Psychosis from Bash of the Beach 96. I mean, they'd taken that kind of match all over the world. They'd worked War, they'd worked ECW, they'd obviously gone all over in Mexico with it as well. And fantastic match, you know, really maybe one of the best opening matches to a pay-per-view ever. Really, really enjoyed that match. Definitely worth seeking out for people. I mean, obviously, Bash at the Beach 96, overshadowed by the NWO formation, the Hogan heel turn, but that is definitely something that people should check out.
Right.
And another one that I really, really liked, and a lot of people, I think this match is, a lot of people who listen may have heard of this match being good, but I may not have watched it. Others may have done. But that's the Midnight Express Southern Boys match from Great American Bash 1990.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That may be one of my favorite tag matches of all time. A classic Southern style tag match between, you know, the Southern Boys, which were Tracy Smothers and was it Brad? No, which Armstrong was it? It's in the Southern
Steve?
Boys.
I think it was Steve Armstrong.
Yeah, I think it was Steve Armstrong, the wild-eyed Southern Boys.
Yes.
Really, really good match. That's worth seeking out. Other matches people might not be aware of, there was a really good lucha match at Bash at the Beach 97, which was Hoovy, Hector Garza, Liz Mark Jr. Versus La Parka, Psychosis, and Villano 4. Obviously, it's just crazy as heck. The guys all going mad, but it was like a lucha tag. It was on crack cocaine, everything. They were just going for absolutely everything. They hit everything perfectly, and the crowd were well into this match. And that's the thing as well, just as a takeaway from this, WCW had better fans to react into people that they may not have been familiar with than WWF. A lot of WWF, if they'd only seen guys a few times, may sit on their hands. WCW crowds were a little bit more lively, a little bit more vocal about the non-quote-unquote stars. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I did prefer WCW around this era than the WWF, just because the fans were a little bit more into the matches.
They were. And I think this was so new to a lot of them, too, that it was just, like, crazy. Like, when WWF would import guys like this, they weren't putting on stunt shows like that. I mean, you know, Hakushi was maybe one of the few, him and, like, 1-2-3 Kid, not together but separately, were guys that were taken to the air a little bit. But even when they'd bring in stars from Mexico, you know, it'd be from AAA, it'd be, you know, Cibernetico, and they'd peer off. And these other guys that were just, they were wrestling, like, mat-based style. They weren't wrestling what these guys are doing with stunt show car crashes. So, I mean, you know, they're opening the show with it, which is brilliant, getting the crowd fired up. And you even hear it today, like, oh, you know, 205 Live, these guys are being stuck in, you know, the 10 o'clock hour, or they're not getting the crowd going. Yeah, because they're not doing stunt shows. Like, there's a difference. The WWE's Cruiserweight division is more, they're trying to make it more character and, like, work-based, whereas WCW, these guys were given, like, 7 minutes. They were told to go out there and just do whatever the fuck they wanted to do. And they would just have these crazy matches that never stopped. They're flying all over the place. And that was a big part of why they got over, why the legend gets over that, oh, you know, they started the show off with a hot match every time. Yeah, because they just let these guys go out there and be crazy a lot of the time. And it worked. I mean, I think that's a big piece of it, no?
Oh, no, I agree. And I think WWF was slightly off the mark, as you mentioned, when they brought in some guys from Mexico, that kind of stuff in early 96 at the Royal Rumble. They were bringing, like, Piroth Jr. in. Fantastic talent, but not someone that would instantly connect. You need to build a guy like that up if he was going to get any traction in the WWF.
Right. He wasn't just going to go out there and wow you. I mean, you know, these guys, they tried to put that on, like, Hector Garza. And, you know, he did a few big moves, but it just wasn't the same. They, you know, they didn't have the big crazy looks like the WCW ones had, you know, like Psicosis and Juventud and La Parca, and, you know, all these guys have unique creative looks that are out there. Just, you know, they look just nuts, like flying around out there. Just, it was such a difference in what they tried to do.
Oh, yeah, and that's why I did prefer kind of Nitro around this time than Raw. But Raw did pick up in 97, to be fair, the whole Hart Foundation stuff. So I'm not going to slight them. But, yeah, WCW had a far better, interesting undercard than WWF. I think that was always the rule of thumb. WCW undercard, WWF main events. If you got both on one, if they combined the two onto one show, you'd have this super amazing show every right. single time. But unfortunately, that didn't happen. But we did have a fair mix here, a bit of choice between the two promotions. But I'm just going to quickly go through my top 10 matches. Number one, we had Ric Flair, Ricky Steamboat, Clash 6, which was the Wrestling Observer 1989 match of the year, and it's the match number 2 in the trilogy. Just amazing. And everyone's probably seen that match now, so I'm not going to harp on about it, but it was definitely fantastic. Number 2, Ric Flair, Ricky Steamboat, Chaito Rumble 89. Again, that was fantastic. If people want to watch that show again, look out for Dave Meltzer on the front row marking out massively to that match. Definitely want to check out. And then thirdly would be the third Ricky Steamboat Ric Flair trilogy, WrestleWar 89. And that's the whole one with the Terry Funk turn. Yeah. And, you know, so those three matches, absolutely fantastic.
Let me ask you this. And if they're in your top 10, you're going to get to them. It's okay. But where do the 94 Flair Steamboats check in for you? The one at Spring Stampede and then the one on TV. Like, do those pop for you too? Or, I mean, do they feel like, I know they weren't as good, but they just like a slight step behind.
Yeah, I would say there was a slight slip behind. I mean, there's matches I prefer to that. They featured guy Flair Luger, to be honest. I think there's two Flair Luger matches that people mm-hmm. really should check out. I mean, there's this awful narrative that people still try and, you know, post Lex Luger wasn't good, he was no good. You know, go back and watch Starrcade 88. I have it as number 8, my favourite WCW match. It's basically Flair defending the title against Luger. Luger at this point was peak. He was really, really good, mm-hmm. solid. Not fancy, but good worker. And that
him and Wyndham, too, had that great match.
Yeah, no, those two had as well. But yeah, Luger, 88, 89, that was, you know, it was really, really enjoyable. And the second match between the two was at WrestleWar 90 as well. So Luger had a good 90 as well. So Ric Flair Luger 88 and Ric Flair Luger in 90, both matches were checking out. So Luger isn't this awful guy that people picture. Mm-mm. Yeah, it progressively got worse as he stopped caring more in the, you know, 91, 92. Then he went to the WWF and wasn't great then. Didn't set the world alight. But then when he went back to WCW, it wasn't too bad. He was mixed up a lot of rubbish with the Dungeon of Doom and kind of that stuff. But his face run in 97 was fantastic, you know, when he won the title.
Right, I thought a lot of it had to do with his energy. You know, that was a big part of it. He was fired up, energetic. The crowd was into him. He could just go out there and yell for 3 minutes and then, you know, rack a guy. The rack got super over. Yeah, I mean, he wasn't blowing the doors off work rate-wise, but he had the energy, charisma, and what he had learned behind it to make up for what he had, you know, lost a step in the ring. And that's something that he had lacked for a while since, like, 91.
Yeah, so I think a motivated Luger was a good worker. So hopefully people can kind of check out those matches if you've not before and make your own mind up yourself. But I think hopefully you'll agree with us. Number 4 for me, I had Eddie Guerrero Ray Jr. from Title versus Mask, Halloween Havoc 97. What can I say? Awesome match. I think it was voted number 1 best WCW match in the 90s by Death Valley Driver video forum or group. Fantastic match, you know. Not very long, it doesn't go, you know, super long, it doesn't go over 20 minutes, but, you know, just move after move, everything's hit just perfectly. You know, that is the peak of that style, I would say.
Yeah, I agree 100%.
And then just going through the rest of them then, so we had Ric Flair, Terry Funk, the I Quit match 89. It was really good you know, fantastic brawl between the two. Worth checking out. Then we had War Games 92 we touched on the previous episode. The Rage Union Psychosis match we spoke about. Then we had, I had Flair Luger at Starrcade in 88. Then I had the Nasty Boys Cactus Jack and Sullivan match at Slamboree, the street fight. That was the one where Dave Schultz, was he the famous Philly hockey player?
Yes, yep, that was him.
Yeah, because I wasn't fully aware who he was to kind of look him up. But yeah, Dave Schultz was the ref for that. Was he known as kind of a rough kind of fighter in hockey?
Yes, yeah, he was like an enforcer.
So that was the idea of using him in that match then. So that's a fantastic, you know, really crazy street fight. Falls Count Anywhere match really between the two at Slamboree. So check that out. And finally, number 10 for me, Ultimo Dragon Rage Union at World War III in 96. That was when Ultimo Dragon was defending his J Crown, which was the eight championships against Rey. It was Japan versus Mexico. It was kind of pushed like that. Really, really great opener. Again, one of my top five pay-per-view openers probably ever. So that's, again, worth checking out. So they're my top 10 matches. So is there any that you want to speak about quickly that I've not really gone through?
Yeah, I mean, you covered the majority in the top 10. I'll just touch on a few other ones that may get overlooked. Brian Pillman versus Johnny B. Badd, the opener from Fall Brawl 95. Excellent match right before Pillman turns heel. We watched that on the Dangerous Alliance like a couple years ago. Me and Will went and live watched it. It holds up. It's a really fun match. And it was kind of, I think it was one of Johnny B. Badd's like really big breakthrough matches before he went to WWF. Sting and Luger versus the Steiners, Super Brawl in 1991. Super Brawl 1, that was a great match. Of course, we mentioned War Games from 91 last week, which was great. But how about the War Games from 94? May not be the best work match, but my God, like the veterans in that match, I just knew how to build the crowd, hype the crowd. And to me, it's the last great, like, traditional WCW match. It's Dusty, Dustin, and the Nasty Boys against the Stud Stable. I believe it was a Buck, Bunkhouse Buck, Colonel Parker. Do you remember the other two guys?
Dick Slater, I think.
Was he in
Ming,
that match?
Maybe.
Ming was definitely in that match. It was Ming. I don't think it was Dick Slater. Was it Rob Parker himself? Yeah, Arn. Terry Funk, Arn Anderson, yeah. Bunkhouse Buck, and Colonel Rob. And then Ming comes in at the end and he bashes the chair or whatever. But the build to that was awesome. That tremendous promo that Dusty and Dustin give where they reunite on the Clash and Dusty accepts his, you know, request, and then they go find the Nasties in the bar. One of my favorite War Games matches. So to me, that's one that's big time under the radar. That's just a ton of fun. You have Rude versus Steamboat at Beach Blast in the Iron Man match. Their feud was great in 92. Rude, one of the best workers in the world in 1992, and it's on, you know, fully on display there. You got all the Sting Vader stuff. Tremendous. So yeah, I mean, just so many really fun matches. Even matches that have dead crowds, like Benoit Malenko at Hog Wild, where no one wanted to be there to watch it because it was just all the bikers that hated them. But it was a tremendous match. So, I mean, so much good stuff in WCW. A lot of it, obviously, pretty much all of it, is either on the network or can be easily found online or through various DVD sets or whatever that you can order out there. So, I mean, there's a lot of good stuff that's worth digging out. You always hear about the goofiness. And, you know, of course, we're here to talk about that, too, on Letters from Center Stage. But the quality of wrestling, I think most people would argue, was always more consistent than with the WWF. I mean, you were, you know, on the random episode of Saturday Night, you were very likely to get like a 3 to 3.5 star match out there just randomly with, you know, if they just throw like a random six man with the Dangerous Alliance or a random six man with Wyndham and Rhodes. And there's so many guys that just throw out there and eat up 20 minutes.
Yeah, they don't stand out as much as the good TV matches in the WWF around.
Because there's more of them, right, I think?
Exactly. Yeah. The body of work was greater. If there's any good matches, I always tweet them out when I do On This Day in History that I put on my Twitter. If there's any good TV matches, it's normally stuff from 92, you know, the tag matches, Dangerous Alliance stuff, they're working against, say, combinations of Barry Windham, Dustin Rhodes, Nikita Koloff, those type of guys, Sting. I'll always tweet them out and put like a match star rating with them as well. But yeah, getting back to the question you asked me before about Steamboat and Flair, their best match in 94, I would have said, was probably Saturday Night that they had on 5/15/94.
Right, the fallout from Space
really,
Stampede.
They really went all out between, you know, those two at the time. I thought that was an awesome match.
It was, because Spring Stampede, they go to the draw where Steamboat does the chicken wing again and they fall back and they both get pinned. And then they fought on Saturday Night for the title again and Flair beats them. And that was pretty much the end of Flair's face run. He would turn heel just about right after that when he combines the titles against Sting and then fights Hogan. So that's kind of Flair's last hurrah during that really fun face Flair run from early 94. And it's pretty much it for Steamboat. He'd hang around a little bit toward the end of 94, right? Doesn't he is that when he has a feud with Austin? So
yeah, he has a match with Austin that's pretty good a bit later on in his run. But this was his last great match. I mean, the match itself nearly went an hour. Really, really good match. People were seeking out. But a lot of these matches I've talked about, I went through the time and kind of found them all on YouTube. That, you know, I think they've been up for quite a long time, a lot of these matches. So I don't think they're going to go anywhere. But if you haven't got the network and you want to see Flair versus Steamboat or things of that nature that I've mentioned, yeah, they're definitely on the playlist. So check that out, guys.
For sure.
So, yeah, I think that's answered all the questions in the Plunder Bucket this week, JT. And I've had a hoop going through the Crystal Chandelier nightclub stuff all the way through to these great matches.
I'm out of ones. I've got to get out of the Crystal Chandelier.
Oh, God, yeah. Fantastic WCW journey again. So shall we do the plug, JT?
Yeah, and I do want to plug something that's kind of big. It just launched a week ago. It is the Greatest WWE Wrestler Ever Project, of course, a spinoff of the PWO Greatest Wrestler Ever that destroyed wrestling internet for a while. But we are going to do it hopefully much more harmoniously. But we're having put our own little twist on it as well. We are looking at the greatest wrestler ever to compete in a WWF WWE ring, but with the caveat to that you can only consider their run in the auspices of WWF WWE. So Ric Flair, you can only consider his work there. All of his other work does not count. So, I mean, this will dramatically shift the paradigm of the list. We're going to do a very similar manner. We're going to have a Facebook group page where we're going to have all our discussions and our nominations. And then we're going to ask everyone to build a list of their top 100. We'll take the rankings, we'll vote them out, and we'll see how the list turns out. This is going to be going for a while. We want to give people plenty of time to do the research. So we're looking at year end probably before the lists need to be submitted. But be sure to check that out. It's on the main Placement Nation site. If you just search Greatest WWE Wrestler Ever Project, you'll be able to find it. Or just go through the index or the archives and you'll find the piece there. And it has all the links. We have a Google Doc that'll have all the nominees in case you're not on Facebook. But if you want to be part of the discussion and the nomination process, Facebook is where it's at. We have a group page going there. And that should please guys like Aubrey who hate message boards. So we're happy about that. Also, of course, on Twitter, PlaceNumber2BNation, Facebook.com/PlaceToBeNation. Subscribe to all of our podcast feeds on iTunes, PlaceToBeNation Wrestling, PlaceToBeNation Pop, and Pro Wrestling Only. Rate, leave feedback. That helps us quite a bit. Shop with us too, PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon.
Wow, that's plenty of plugs. Check those out, guys, especially the project. I'm going to be involved in that. Early thoughts for me jumping out as maybe number one, maybe a Randy Savage. But, you know, I'm probably overlooking a hell of a lot of people there when I'm just saying that off the top of my head. But, yeah, they're definitely everyone should get involved with because it'll be a whole heap of fun. So just before we wrap things up, follow me at Alan_Cheapshot. That's Alan_Cheapshot. You can send questions in that way or Justin said to @Place2BNation, and you can also write to us on letters@gmail.com. So that's it, guys. Thank you so much for listening to episode number 7 of Letters from Center Stage. JT, thank you very much, and I will see you again in a week.
Sounds good. Talk to you then. Take care.
At the Mauler, completely maul his opponent, Steve Dawg.
The Honky Tonk Man is your winner.
One more time. Hey, there's the guy from Deliverance.
Ah! It's not hot.
We need a red-headed booger, you.
Is it spread?
Yes.
You can't find your scissors? Wow!